resistance and have them executed immediately afterwards. These developments together added a bloody internecine dimension to France's resistance war. The military government in Brussels was able to block the appointment of a senior SS and police leader until July 1944. Instead, it wielded the security hatchet harshly itself. On 27 November 1942, 8 hostages were executed at Charleroi, the first of a total of 240 who would perish before July 1944. The military government had a large network of police informants and was perfectly prepared to exploit the extensive use of torture by the security police. The Germans failed to destroy the Belgian resistance entirely, but did manage to arrest 4,700 people between March 1943 and February 1944, and around another 1,000 during each of the remaining months of occupation. Matters became more brutal still during the last 3 months of occupation, when German police began taking out supposed resistance fighters whom they had caught in the act. The military government still sought the collaboration of the established Belgian administration. In January 1944, for instance, it agreed that Belgian judicial authorities could continue to investigate instances of armed crime, including resistance attacks, without having to inform the German authorities. But as the Belgian police itself became ever less trustworthy, the military government relied increasingly upon Rexists and other extremist collaborators for a range of policing duties. Thus was the increasingly bitter internecine violence between collaborators and resistance in France replicated in Belgium. By 1944, assassinations of collaborators and sometimes of German soldiers were on the rise, and isolated rural areas of Belgium remained only under nominal German control. Yet none of this alarmed the German occupiers as much as the rise of the Maquis in France. By the end of the summer of 1943, there were at least 13,000 Maquisards at liberty in the French countryside. Two things above all drove this development: the population's bitter resentment towards the STO, and the copious mountainous and forested regions of the former Free Zone. Even a few German soldiers deserted to join the Maquis. They may have been influenced by a German-language bulletin, Soldat im Westen, Soldier in the West, which was the joint work of French communists and a group of German conscripts who had once been members of the Communist Party of Germany. They were certainly influenced by the fear of being sent to the Eastern Front. The Maquis did not prosecute guerrilla warfare on a large scale until early 1944, and only then, once they were benefiting from weapon supplies and better organization coordinated from London. But German units in the countryside already saw the signs by the autumn of 1943. "What use is there in handling the French and Belgians with kid gloves?" wondered General Hans von Salmuth, now commander of the 15th Army under O.B. West. Soldiers on the ground began to experience the Maquis threat at first hand. In early March 1944, Michael H. wrote to his parents, "A French policeman who recently shot 4 terrorists went into a bakery one lunchtime. 2 civilians, covert terrorists, walked in. They chatted with the policeman, then one of them pulled out a pistol and shot the policeman 7 times in the head. Soon this sort of thing is going to be happening daily across the whole area." On 26 March, the resistance shot a sentry in his unit, which burned down 4 houses in retaliation. But the most spectacular Maquis attack of early 1944 took place when it coordinated with the SOE and other French resistance groups to blow up the aircraft factory at Figeac, 150 kilometers, 94 miles, east of Bordeaux. By the spring of 1944, the Germans were fighting the first of many full-scale armed engagements with the Maquis. To a great extent, the Germans imported methods from the east, employing Großunternehmen, Jagdkommandos, and motorized raiding columns. Generally, the army confined itself to the military side of such operations, while the security police and SD had a free hand in carrying out the after-action interrogations and reprisals. In May 1944, the army reclaimed its own freedom to shoot captured partisans and burn down individual houses, but it still handed over partisans, accomplices, and suspects to the security police and SD. The army itself was not exactly an oasis of restraint in matters of anti-partisan warfare. As an Allied invasion of Western Europe loomed, commanders increasingly put the well-being of their own troops before what they considered to be restrictive legal niceties. Among other things, they increasingly dismissed Article 50 of the Hague Convention, which forbade the occupier from inflicting collective punishments upon the general population for attacks by individuals. Army commanders reasoned that Article 50 did not apply in a battle zone, something France was clearly on the cusp of becoming. And in March 1944, Luftwaffe Field Marshal Hugo Sperle, second in command at OB West, directed, "Sloppy and indecisive commanders must be punished, because they endanger their men's security and the respect for the German Wehrmacht. Given current conditions, it is forbidden to penalize excessively harsh measures." But in other respects, army commanders in France did show more restraint than their colleagues in the Soviet Union and Southeast Europe. OB West directed that only divisional commanders or senior SS and police leaders had the authority to order collective reprisals, and even then only selectively. And while Karl Heinrich von Stulpnagel urged the troops to be merciless towards partisans, he went against the grain of Hitler's December 1942 directive by explicitly excluding women, children, or anyone without a weapon from such brutal treatment. On the other hand, neither the military government nor OB West ever prosecuted German soldiers who had committed such vicious excesses. As a result, the troops operated under a corpus of commands that did not consistently urge them to be brutal, but certainly confused them at the same time by letting them push the boundaries of brutality. Yet during the first full-on battles between the Maquis and the Germans in the mountainous regions of southern France, regular army units behaved less ferociously than their SS and police comrades. After one operation in the French Jura, Lieutenant General Karl Pflaum, commander of the 157th Reserve Infantry Division, informed the commandant of the army area southern France that though he conceded that the security police and SD's ruthless methods discouraged civilians from helping partisans, he wanted his own men to have nothing to do with them. The troops dislike such measures intensely, for the innocent very often suffer as a result. Instead, he declared, the troops would do what is necessary, but avoid committing any injustice or practicing undue harshness. The wording was mild, but clear. Once the Allied invasion of Western Europe was underway, the effort of fighting partisans in the rear at the same time as fighting Allied armies at the front would lower the army's threshold of ruthlessness. Even then, however, the army did not import Eastern Front measures wholesale. Far more than the Soviet Union and much of southern Europe, then, France was a region where the army still paid some heed to moral and legal constraints. The fact that Nazi ideology did not consider the French racially backward, born of natural bandit stock, or tainted by any of the other inferior traits supposedly intrinsic to eastern populations, doubtless helped to moderate the army's conduct. On the other hand, the army was still complicit, if not always enthusiastically or directly, in the more avowedly Eastern-style security methods of the SS and police. While resistance in France continued to grow, so too did the prospect of Allied invasion. The centerpiece of German fortifications along the coasts of France and Belgium was the Atlantic Wall. Hitler was not so delusional as to think that this alone could stop the Allies. He considered it part of a bigger defense system, including static and mobile elements. But he certainly envisioned it playing an important part in delaying or at least containing any Allied landing. Overseeing the building of the Atlantic Wall was Field Marshal Rommel. The wall was a series of defensive lines, beginning with the line where Rommel believed the Allies would be most vulnerable, the sea. He ordered the coastal waters to be riddled with sea mines, and the water near the shoreline with other underwater obstacles. The beaches themselves were to be riddled with anti-personnel and anti-tank mines, and with other anti-tank obstacles. Behind these, finally, was to be a network of concrete bunkers housing machine gun posts and, at some points, albeit largely for the benefit of the propaganda newsreels, gigantic gun emplacements. The human cost of constructing the Atlantic Wall was considerable. To make way for the fortifications, over 300,000 people were forced to evacuate their homes. There were particularly large evacuations from key ports. The German army deployed OT construction workers recruited from the local population, and also hundreds of thousands of labourers, essentially slave workers from Eastern Europe. Field Marshal von Rundstedt, Commander-in-Chief West, once more displayed his predilection for ruthless military necessity by proclaiming that the best way to discourage such workers from being disobedient or sluggish was to shoot them. To deter the French resistance from attacking railway stations and tracks, he ordered that local residents be seized as hostages. The 68-year-old Rundstedt showed that age was no obstacle to ruthlessness. Some of his subordinates proved more humane. For instance, when the invasion began, 25 corps stationed in Brittany opposed efforts by the security police to gather respected citizens as hostages. Army units in the West were also often averse to implementing Hitler's October 1942 order to shoot captured Allied commandos. Rommel appears to have ignored it during his time in France. But the record was not unblemished. Some units handed over Allied commandos to the security police and SD, and two army divisions also issued orders to hand over downed Allied airmen. How far such orders were followed, or what fate befell transferred Allied personnel, is unclear. What was clear was the illegality of the commando order and its follow-ups. The reality of the Atlantic Wall was less impressive than the propaganda newsreels claimed. Many workers had to be withdrawn as Allied air raids and resistance saboteurs hit industrial plants and transport. In April 1944, workers were also diverted to working the farms so that French agriculture could continue to meet German domestic demand. And although the Atlantic Wall was formidably arrayed along those sections of coast deemed likelier targets for an Allied landing, it was not formidably arrayed in Normandy. At the start of June 1944, the army in the west, the Westheer, contained 58 divisions of varying quality. Some battalions had been sent to the Eastern Front and replaced by battalions of Osttruppen, Russian troops in German service, or Germanic troops from Poland. Both troop types were of doubtful quality and morale. The Westheer was extensively trained and retrained as it awaited the Allied invasion. By the spring of 1944, the addition of Jagdpanzers, rocket launchers, light anti-aircraft guns, and heavy mortars for infantry divisions had increased the Westheer's average divisional strength by 15%. But the increase in the division's armed punch was bought at the cost of their logistical tail. Technically, this lagged decades behind the division's combat formations. Its mainstays were the horse and the bicycle. Such a transport system was dangerously susceptible to collapse once the divisions were committed to combat. On paper, the Westheer's panzer divisions looked more impressive than its infantry divisions. They were collectively designated Panzer Group West under General of Panzer Troops Leo Geier von Schweppenburg. However, the 11th and 116th Panzer Divisions were still retraining their forces when D-Day came, and of the 10 mechanized German divisions in the West on 6 June 1944, only the 2nd Panzer Division was fully combat-ready. And although the Westheer did include numerous good-quality combat divisions by June 1944, the majority of these were under the 15th Army in Belgium and northeast France. Of the 468,000 men under Army Group B in early April 1944, only 161,000 fell under the command of Colonel General Friedrich Dollmann's 7th Army in Normandy. The 7th Army largely comprised poorer quality divisions, including several stationary formations. Many 7th Army divisions also had to make do with poorer quality captured equipment and with medical units lacking adequate transport. Nor were there any reserves to speak of. 40% of the 7th Army's troops had combat experience, but another 40% were young recruits, and the remaining 20% comprised older men drawn from clear-outs of the civilian sector. The large proportion of Etappenschweine in the 7th Army, together with the temptations conjured by the relative wealth of the West, probably help explain why the 7th Army's discipline was also on the slide. During the first 6 months of 1944, the 7th Army recorded 562 cases of property theft. In the East, the 16th Army recorded only 34 cases during approximately the same period, while the 20th Mountain Army, stationed in the particularly wild northernmost sector of the Eastern Front, recorded just 19 cases for the whole of 1944. Senior commanders tried to compensate for the defects across the Westheer by ratcheting up indoctrination. In March 1944, the Army's field marshals collectively pledged that every soldier would be a fanatical fighter in the cause of Nazi Germany's future. O.B. West compelled officers commanding the Atlantic Wall bunkers to swear an oath that they would defend their positions to the last. But the reality in France was different, for the generals knew that the prospect of surrendering to the Western Allies terrified the troops far less than the prospect of surrendering, or trying to surrender, to the Red Army. Goebbels intensified anti-British and anti-American propaganda. Among other things, he invoked the Anglo-American bombing of the Reich to try to persuade the troops that the Western Allies were fundamentally uncivilized. The Wehrmacht followed suit. 15th Army propaganda, for instance, demonized the Western Allies as the plutocratic masses of world Jewry. The Anglo-Americans, with their masks slipped, not a hair separating them from the Bolshevik, as full of annihilating lust as the Red Army Asiatic. The sky gangsters who are destroying the Heimat and killing your children, wives, parents, and grandparents. General Jodl believed such messages would inspire the troops to fight to the last. Then we shall see who fights better and who dies easier, the German soldier threatened with the destruction of his homeland, or the Americans and British who no longer know why they are fighting in Europe. It is unclear how the troops themselves regarded such propaganda. Relations with the High Command were as troubled as conditions on the ground. Hitler, as both supreme commander of the Wehrmacht and commander-in-chief of the army, would have been out of his depth at the best of times, but in the early summer of 1944 he would face the overwhelming responsibility of three active battlefronts at once. Too much power was concentrated in his person and too little in Rundstedt. In particular, the latter lacked proper control over his subordinate armies and army groups. Not that Rundstedt was the most dynamic of theater commanders. Hans Speidel, who in April 1944 became chief of staff to Army Group B, noted after the war, "Rundstedt had lost with advancing age the creative impulse and the clear sense of responsibility to the nation. He seemed to think that the height of wisdom was to make studied representations and write grave situation reports. He left actions to others. When Rommel sought to move him to send joint demands to Hitler, Rundstedt exclaimed, 'You are young. The people know you and love you. You do it.'" The Allies, by contrast, had in the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force, SHAEF, a coordinating body that assured them of far better organization and cohesion. The Supreme Allied Commander, General Eisenhower, was American, but for balance, the heads of the ground, naval, and air forces assigned to the invasion of Western Europe, Montgomery, Ramsay, and Lee Mallory, respectively, were British. What Eisenhower lacked in field command brilliance, he more than made up for in his managerial and coordinating talents. The same could not be said of Hitler. The most pressing strategic dilemma facing the Westheer was where to deploy its panzers. Rundstedt, together with Geyer von Schweppenburg, wanted Panzergruppe West held back as a central reserve. This, they believed, would enable the panzers to counterattack on ground of the Germans' choosing, and avoid the heavier losses they might suffer to Allied warships or aircraft if they were deployed along the coast. Rommel, however, believed the Allies must be pushed into the sea as soon as they landed. He also believed that any value an armored reserve possessed would be cancelled out by the damage Allied bombers and resistance sabotage could inflict upon any effort to transport it. Hitler eventually settled on a compromise that satisfied nobody. He deployed some panzers centrally and some near the coast, with neither concentration strong enough for its purpose. Furthermore, Rundstedt's centrally located panzers were forbidden to move without Hitler's explicit permission, and the coastal panzer deployments were concentrated predominantly northeast of Normandy. Rommel undoubtedly had the better argument. He at least understood something of the damage air power might wreak upon efforts to bring the panzers far forward from the rear. By contrast, Geir von Schwerpenburg's lengthy experience on the Eastern Front left him unprepared to face air power of the magnitude the Western Allies would be able to muster. Yet so powerful was Allied strength in the air, and so limited German air cover, that Rommel's preferred coastal deployment probably would not have altered the outcome of D-Day either. And German air cover was indeed limited. Such were the defects in pilot training, the air defense needs of the Reich itself, and the effect of Allied bombing upon German aircraft production that the Luftwaffe in the West could muster an absolute maximum of about 1,650 operational aircraft against Allied invasion. Moreover, the Luftwaffe in the West dispersed its fighter cover across airfields in France and the Low Countries, partly because it did not know where the Allies would land, and partly for fear that concentrating large numbers of fighters on the ground would gift Allied bombers with easy targets. Allied bombing was already putting pressure on Luftwaffe airfields, even when they were camouflaged. Efforts to keep the Luftwaffe airborne suffered further from the Allies' bombing of German oil production facilities. The Allies now had the P-51 Mustang, a fighter aircraft with a range that enabled it to protect a bomber force all the way into Germany and back. Thus could Allied air chiefs couple their attacks on oil production with an interdiction campaign to degrade transport infrastructure before D-Day, attacking vehicles, railways, roads, and canals. Only the intransigence of Sir Arthur Harris, the head of RAF Bomber Command, who was peeved that his forces were being diverted from obliterating German cities, prevented the interdiction campaign from achieving its full effect until the 2 months following D-Day. But Allied air power was already achieving its full effect against the Luftwaffe, destroying its planes in the air, on the ground, or, most devastatingly, at source. During 1944, the Luftwaffe lost 15,000 aircraft at the pre-production, deployment, and non-operational stages. Senior field commanders of the Wehrmacht and Waffen-SS remained fairly hopeful that they could push the Allies back into the sea. However, this confidence was based largely on the Germans' defeat of the major Allied commando raid on Dieppe in 1942. On that occasion, Canadian troops had assaulted a fortified harbour and suffered predictably dreadful losses. But the Dieppe raid bore no resemblance to the prospect the Westheer faced in 1944. Sicily and Salerno had taught the Allies much about how landings should be conducted. They would be landing not in harbours, but on five proximate invasion beaches, from west to east, Utah, Omaha, Gold, Juneau, and Sword. They would be supported by immense firepower from the air and sea, and had also learned how to organize landings logistically and assemble forces on the beaches before pushing inland. The Germans faced a trifibious operation of a kind to which they had had no answer in Sicily and at Salerno. Even when they had faced a limited Allied landing at Anzio, they had done no more than check it temporarily. Now they faced the same challenge, but on an even bigger scale. By the night of 5 to 6 June 1944, poor weather had delayed the Allied landings on the Normandy coast by 1 day, but had also made the Germans complacent. That night, the Allies staged airborne landings in Normandy to cut communications and hold off German reinforcements on D-Day itself. They sowed confusion with bogus landings and had also managed to jam numerous German radar stations. The 7th Army was the only German field formation that put its subordinate units on immediate alert that night. Rundstedt only followed at 0410, an hour and a half before the first U.S. landings at Utah and Omaha. German forces already on the coast were thus ready to meet the invaders, just, but the delay prevented reserves from getting to the coast in time. The conventional story goes that Hitler was asleep, and that had he been woken up, he could have moved the Panzerlehr Division and the 12th SS Panzer Division to the coast. But Rundstedt failed to send Hitler a proper situation report in the first place. Only in the late afternoon were two divisions released from Army Group B, too late to have any chance of altering the outcome on D-Day. Rommel was in Germany at his wife's birthday party when the Allies landed, but several divisional commanders were also caught napping. The second-rate commander of 21st Panzer Division, Major General Edgar Feuchtinger, owed his position to his party connections, and was in Paris with his mistress when the invasion started. Speidel, left in charge of Army Group B until Rommel sped back to his headquarters that afternoon, was sluggish and spent too long waiting for a full report. Probably the root cause of the Germans' hesitancy on D-Day, however, was that they did not know for sure whether this was a full-scale attack or a feint to divert attention from a bigger landing on the Pas-de-Calais. Hitler alone cannot be blamed for this misjudgment. German commanders may also have become susceptible, temporarily, to a destructive groupthink, as German military intelligence and senior German commanders continued trying to justify themselves by concurring with their earlier view that Normandy was not the main invasion target. The Allies had efficiently assembled an armada of nearly 7,000 vessels, free from any significant interference by the Kriegsmarine. Allied navies had long since countered the U-boat threat. By June 1944, the Germans had only three warships larger than a destroyer, and none of these was within striking range of the channel. The Kriegsmarine was reduced to launching pinprick attacks with U-boats, and, even more desperately, frogmen against the invasion fleet when it was crossing the channel and once it had got into port. Allied warships used artificial fog to block the German beach defenders' sights. However, though Allied bombing and naval firepower might have kept the coastal defenders' heads down, they caused relatively little damage to the defenses themselves that morning. Among other things, Allied aircraft dropped many of their bombs some distance back from the beaches, and heavy cloud hindered fighter bombers. But Allied air power did prevent the Luftwaffe from having any impact on the battle that day, and in doing so stripped German ground forces of their air cover. The Luftwaffe was eventually able to cobble together 1,000 aircraft, but Allied air superiority and relentless pressure on Luftwaffe airfields prevented most aircraft from reaching the actual battlefield. Allied air forces flew 12,000 sorties on D-Day, next to the Luftwaffe's 300. Benefiting also from the patchy German coastal defences in Normandy, the first Allied attack wave to hit the beaches deployed flail tanks and other innovative methods to crush mines and other obstacles. Allied casualties were still considerable, however. On Omaha Beach, the Americans landed amid challenging topography against the unexpectedly heavy troop concentrations of the 352nd Infantry Division, and suffered grievous losses before they prevailed. The Germans also defended fiercely on other sectors of the coast. On Juno Beach, for instance, soldiers of the 716th Infantry Division reduced one company of the Royal Winnipeg Rifles to one officer and 26 men. But of all the Westheer's armored divisions, only the 21st Panzer Division went into action on D-Day itself, against the British and Canadians between Gold Beach and Sword Beach. Even then, it received the order 2 hours late, presumably after Feuchtinger had finished tucking his shirt in, and British Sherman Firefly tank destroyers inflicted heavy losses upon it. Oberführer Fritz Krämer, chief of staff of 1 SS Panzer Corps, commented bitterly on the squandering of what he believed had been a decisive opportunity. "By premature commitments in driblets," he told the Americans after the war, "the Germans missed their opportunity to stake everything on one card, to lose or win all." By the end of 6 June, the Allies had already brought 160,000 troops ashore. Even a more timely and fulsome response might also have failed to drive the Allies back into the channel. But if the Germans ever did have a chance of this, or at least of containing the bridgehead, they would have probably lost it by the end of 6 June. And even then, the week following D-Day saw the conclusive ruin of all their further efforts to this end. The Allies continued to assert their dominance of the air. During the first few days of the Normandy campaign, the Luftwaffe lost a daily average of around 100 aircraft, and many German units were hobbled not only by their fear of being caught in the open by Allied aircraft, but also because they lacked mobility or combat readiness in the first place. The Germans often had to commandeer civilian vehicles, but an overall shortage of these compelled them to move by rail. Moving 5 panzer divisions and 10 infantry divisions by rail to Normandy on D-Day would have required 850 trains, an effort of transportation that would have taken a week even if the railway network had not been under massive aerial bombardment. transferring all the Germans' 34 divisions in OB West's area of operations, excluding those of the 7th Army, would have required about three times as many trains. Over the course of June, the Germans eventually managed to commit 88,000 men to the Normandy battlefield, but during the same months the Allies brought 850,000 troops ashore and another 25,000 in by air. The Germans then were unable to commit the weight of numbers they would have needed to contain the Allies, still less push them back into the sea. The Allied invasion of occupied France fell upon a German army whose ability to control its territory was already under strain, as it faced the Maquis threat with a self-defeatingly confused combination of ruthlessness and restraint. During the opening hours and days of the Normandy campaign itself, any effective effort that the Westheere might have made to drive the Allies back into the English Channel was hobbled from several directions. Allied deception operations had fed the German belief that the main landing would be on the Pas-de-Calais. This, together with the Germans' sluggish response and convoluted command arrangements, lost them vital hours on D-Day against a well-planned triphibious assault. Hitler was far from being the only one who called wrong on D-Day. The Allies' air power enabled them to dominate the skies over the battlefield and restricted the Westheer's ability to move its troops. What restricted it even more, however, was the limited capacity of the French transport system, particularly its rail network. But overall, the most important cause of the Germans' failure on D-Day and the days immediately following, because of the more profound impact it had behind the front line, was Allied air power. This factor was already wreaking destruction upon German industry's ability to build and fuel the German army's means of mechanized transportation. Without such destruction, the Westheere would not have been as dependent upon the French rail network in the first place. There were limits to the direct damage that the Allied air forces would be able to inflict upon the Germans over the 10 weeks of fighting in Normandy that were to follow. Nevertheless, air power played the single most important role in setting up the conditions for the defeat of the Westheere in the ground war that now commenced. The fighting in Normandy would not only display the German army's continued strength in defensive warfare, but also further expose the weaknesses that increasingly debilitated it. And the Allied forces in the West were only one of two colossal threats that the German army would face during that summer of 1944. The other would come from the East. Part 5. Defeat, Destruction, and Self-Destruction. Chapter 22. The Greatest Defeat, 1944. The summer of 1944 brought defeat not just in Italy, but also, far more fatefully, in France and in Belarus. The German army would eventually manage to patch up all three fronts, but only temporarily, and not before it had been driven back to Germany's eastern and western frontiers, while suffering massive and irreplaceable losses along the way. Smaller in scale, but pivotally important also, were events that took place in East Prussia and Berlin on 20 July, as the efforts of the military resistance to topple the Nazi regime came to a spectacular but disastrous head. The failure to assassinate Hitler and stage a successful anti-Nazi coup itself heralded momentous changes, one of which was the regime's assault on what little remained of the army's independence. By 13 June 1944, a week into the Normandy campaign, the Westheere had abandoned all attempts to drive the Allies back into the sea. Rommel, who coordinated the battle far more actively than Rundstedt, now sought instead to contain them. "You can be sure this business will never go awry," wrote Private Rolf M., a panzer grenadier with the 2nd Panzer Division. "Rommel, who is leading our operation, is our best field marshal. He frequently visits us. To us Lanzers, he is exactly like a father." Rommel was indeed able to contain the Allies, if only for a time. He was helped in large part by the Normandy landscape, the Bocage country on the westerly sector of the Normandy front where the Germans faced the Americans, was crisscrossed by innumerable hedgerows, providing cover for hidden German infantry and artillery. Further east, the Germans were able to incorporate many villages along the front line with the British and Canadians to create a strong defense network with interlocking fields of fire. The Germans also had a narrow front to defend overall. The best place for an Allied breakout, primarily because it opened the way to a flat expanse of land stretching away to the east, was around the city of Caen. The Canadians failed to take Caen on D-Day itself, partly because they were better trained for the beach landings than for the fighting that followed, and partly because the Germans blocked them with heavy fortifications and rushed the 21st Panzer Division to the sector. On the 13th, the Germans halted a British attempt to take the city at the Battle of Villers-Bocage. The British unwisely attempted sweeping armoured manoeuvres, a form of attack they never grasped as well as the attritional set-piece assault, in landscape ill-suited to it. Attacking successfully amid the Normandy terrain required a level of cooperation between tanks and infantry that the British and Canadians had yet to master. Allied efforts were further frustrated on 19 June when an unseasonably fearsome channel storm wrecked several of the artificial mulberry harbours being assembled on the Normandy coast to disembark and supply follow-up troops. Only on the Cotentin Peninsula, including Cherbourg with its valuable port facilities, did the Germans fold quickly. Cherbourg fell to another of those Allied inter-service assaults to which the Germans had no answer. In particular, the Americans' effective aerial reconnoitering of the port enabled them to call down aerial and naval bombardment to devastating effect. Elsewhere, the Germans resisted stubbornly, exploiting the landscape to optimize their defensive warfare skills. Their forward positions were hammered by aerial and naval bombardment. Hans von Luck, now with the 21st Panzer Division, recalled how naval guns, artillery and fighter bombers plastered us without pause on 7th June. But they soon went over to a dispersed system of defense in depth that deprived the Allied air forces of easy concentrated targets. By embedding the Normandy villages into their defense network, they replicated German tactics in the east. They dug in low, using small mortar pits, machine gun posts, and low-profile anti-tank guns concealed by hedges, and they camouflaged innovatively to try and compensate for their virtually non-existent air cover. The Normandy terrain was ideal country for ambush, and its hillier areas provided countless opportunities to hide artillery on reverse slopes. Panzerschreck, Tanks Bane and Panzerfaust anti-tank rifles have been particularly successful in a country where there are hedges which obstruct visibility, reported the anti-tank battalion of the 277th Infantry Division in mid-July. It also directed that enemy infantry should be allowed to approach as near as possible so that they can be destroyed at closest possible range. Normandy's orchards and woods, its strongly built farmhouses, and the valleys, rivers, and ravines that intersected it, all provided serious obstacles to rapid armored maneuver. German units also placed massive stress, as they had often done in the east, upon tactical reserves that could be rushed in to prevent Allied troops from occupying the main defense line after a heavy barrage. Large masses of troops are not needed for this, asserted the 2nd Panzer Division, but only a few assault detachments. The enemy infantryman is no fighter in our sense of the term, and consequently only a few machine guns are necessary to hold him, but these must be there at the right time. As Hitler and the High Command came to realize that Normandy was indeed the Allies' main invasion target, they directed an influx of seasoned combat units into the line to bolster the many second-rate formations of the 7th Army. Such units could count on good-quality officers and NCOs, and on experienced Eastern Front veterans at all levels. They displayed much of the initiative of old, regularly launching rapid and dogged counterattacks. Some platoons counterattacked within 15 minutes of an Allied attack. The commitment of the V-1 to action and the pledge to unleash even more devastating Wunderwaffen against the Allies were boosting German units' morale, a British Second Army intelligence summary reported. The most telling statistic concerning how many aggressive counterattacks German troops made in Normandy was that the percentage of officers the Westheer lost in 1944 was double the percentage of NCOs and men it lost. Much has been made of the German soldiers' qualitative superiority in the Normandy campaign, and there is indeed much to be said for this. One especially exhaustive study of the Westheer in Normandy concludes that, all other things being equal, 100 German soldiers would have made an even fight against 150 Allied soldiers. In the long run, however, statistics such as this portended the Germans' doom in Normandy. All other things were not equal, for the Allies were now ashore in force and amassing firepower and material in ever greater strength. While aggressive counterattacks might help to stall the Allies' progress, they bled the Westheer's manpower. And that manpower was increasingly precious, for as the German army's domestic manpower pool shrank, replenishing frontline units depleted by constant combat grew increasingly difficult. And in a sense, trying to contain the Allies constrained the Germans even more than their opponents. It was a further lock on their ability to maneuver effectively. Instead, they were increasingly forced to respond to what the Allies were doing, feeding in or redistributing their own troops along the line in a fragmented, reactive fashion. As German armor began arriving in Normandy in greater force, Rommel concentrated the bulk of it on the right flank facing the British and Canadians around Caen. He was aware that an Allied breakout in this sector would quickly ensure access to the Seine and beyond. On the other hand, because Allied armor had greater strength of numbers across the Normandy front as a whole, concentrating more panzers around Caen would make it easier for the Americans eventually to break out in the west. And whilst much has also been made of the Germans' qualitative superiority, tank for tank, here too the picture was not one of unalloyed German strength and Allied failings. That said, the list of defects in Allied AFVs was extensive. To name but a few, the Shermans still caught fire all too easily. The Firefly, the heavily armed British-made variant of the Sherman, was highly visible, and the British Cromwell was fast and manoeuvrable but short on protections and firepower. The British Churchill infantry tank was popular with its crews because it was well protected, but it was not so well protected as to be always impenetrable to the 75mm and 88mm guns of the heaviest German Panzer and Jagdpanzer models. The US M10 tank destroyer, though mobile and effective in anti-tank support, was less effective in attack, and unable to best the heaviest German army save at very close range, which was an especially dicey proposition for its crew, completely exposed in its open turret. The most formidable tank the Germans committed in Normandy was the Panther. By the time of the Normandy campaign, the Panther's design flaws had been ironed out, and it was earning its status as one of the classic tanks of the Second World War. It was relatively fast, its frontal armor so strong that even the Firefly found it a challenge, and its 75mm gun could penetrate Allied armor at distances beyond standard battle range. It could even penetrate the well-protected Churchill at distances of over 914 meters, 1,000 yards. But upstaging the Panther in Allied troops' nightmares was the Tiger. Although the Tiger was slow, it was daunting in the close-quarters defensive fighting that characterized the Normandy campaign. While the Panther might be a better tank all round, the Tiger's 88mm gun outdid it for firepower. Allied troops, armored or otherwise, fell prey to Tiger phobia during the Normandy campaign. The following deservedly oft-quoted exchange between a newly arrived British tank officer and his regimental adjutant conveys this sense of fear in dryly understated fashion. "What do the Germans have most of?" "Panthers. The Panther can slice through a Churchill like butter from a mile away." "And how does a Churchill get a Panther?" "It creeps up on it. When it reaches close quarters, the gunner tries to bounce a shot off the underside of the Panther's gun mantlet. If he's lucky, it goes through a piece of thin armor above the driver's head." "Has anybody ever done it?" "Yes, Davis in C Squadron. He's back with the headquarters now, trying to recover his nerve." "How does a Churchill get a Tiger?" "It's supposed to get within 200 yards and put a shot through the periscope." "Has anyone ever done it?" "No." Back in Britain, the Tiger ignited controversy in the House of Commons when Richard Stokes, Member of Parliament for Ipswich, challenged Secretary of State for War James Grigg to a tank duel in which Stokes would command a Tiger and Grigg a Cromwell. A measure of how far the tiger had cast a spell on Allied troops was the fact that there were not even that many of them in Normandy. All the same, in their fearful imaginings, Allied troops came to think that every German tank they faced was a tiger. The Germans fueled tiger phobia without even meaning to. The Mark IV Panzer often sported a skirt of armor to prevent Allied troops from destroying it from the side with charge weapons. In this state, to the untrained eye, it looked remarkably like a tiger. Indeed, just as at Kursk, the Mark IV was the unsung hero of the German panzer force in Normandy. It was more suitable for camouflage and ambush than the Tiger or Panther, because it was relatively small and did not have a conspicuous overhanging gun. Similarly underrated was the ever-reliable Sturmgeschütz, which, though limited in attack, proved as solid in defence as it did on the Eastern Front. But Allied tanks were narrowing the qualitative gap. The models the Allies employed mixed their aforementioned weaknesses with aforementioned strengths, and the Firefly's 17-pounder gun made it a particularly feared weapon on the battlefield. The crews of the six Panzers destroyed by a single Canadian Firefly on 9 June would have agreed. The famous rampage of SS Panzer ace Michael Wittmann at the Battle of Vieux-Bocage, in which his Tiger single-handedly destroyed a large, if disputed, number of light tanks and other vehicles, loses some of its sheen given that Wittmann made a sharp exit when a Firefly hove into view. Allied armor and combined arms tactics also improved, albeit with an element of muddling through. British armored doctrine confusingly mixed Montgomery's preference for sending in armor ahead of infantry and the more flexible approach the British Home Forces favored. Sending in armor before infantry proved particularly deleterious in Normandy because defending German infantry were able to hide in the undergrowth, allow the armor to pass, beat off or hold off the follow-up infantry, and then turn on the armor's rear. On the other hand, the fact that Montgomery did not enforce this doctrine enabled British units to adapt to conditions. British armor also adapted to the dense Normandy landscape with the Snake Patrol. Their armor would advance in column, the leading tank halting on reaching a bend in the road, then waiting for the second tank to arrive to provide covering fire as the first tank advanced further. And while the Allies developed their armored tactics, the Germans continued to rely on immediate but costly counterattack. German AFVs, moreover, had their own weaknesses. The Mark IV could do little against the Churchill and was easy meat for the Firefly's 17-pounder. The Panther was vulnerable to flanking shots. The Tiger was too slow for armored counterattacks, hard to maintain and still prone to mechanical failure. A German tactical manual of the time asserted that no longer can the Tiger prance around oblivious to the laws of tank tactics. The generally redoubtable Sturmgeschütz often proved too low-lying to be able to shoot over hedges and walls. Furthermore, the effects of truncated training times for panzer crews were becoming apparent. British tank units that had fought in North Africa noted a distinct drop in the quality of panzer crews. If smoke appeared, they would frequently retreat or hastily abandon their vehicle. Standards had also dropped among German anti-tank gunners. "Our anti-tank guns are still firing too soon," reported Panzer Group West at the beginning of August. "Enemy tanks try to draw their fire, and any gun which does fire is soon put out of action." By June 1944, a quarter of all panzer divisions were in the Waffen-SS, but the performances of Waffen-SS and Army panzer divisions in Normandy had little to separate them. Waffen-SS panzer divisions had more panzers and Sturmgeschütze, but the best-equipped formation of all was the Army's Panzerlehr division. Only the singularly fanatical 12th SS Hitlerjugend panzer division suffered markedly higher losses than its army counterparts, not to mention committing bloodthirsty atrocities in a campaign that both sides, by and large, fought cleanly. In terms of fighting power, there was more to distinguish panzer divisions within each branch rather than across them. For instance, the 2nd Panzer Division came in for praise both from Geyer von Schweppenburg and its American opponents, but the 16th Panzer Division, according to 47 Panzer Corps, fails almost always, or practically always. The duel between German and Allied armor then brought mixed results for both sides. But ultimately, for the increasingly depleted Germans, mixed was not good enough. None of this alters the fact that the Germans held off the Allies in Normandy for almost 2 months. For this, they had not only their own strengths to thank, but also Allied weaknesses that were not just technical, but also tactical and operational. The British and Canadians were especially afflicted. Because of the deferential British regimental system and Montgomery's concern that admitting mistakes might damage morale, British after-action reports did not devote enough attention to the improvements needed. While individual British divisions performed well, the army still failed to disseminate best practice effectively. British infantry held up well against frontal attacks, but were vulnerable to flanking attacks and infiltration. Not only green formations, but also some battle-weary veteran ones frequently fell short of the expectations placed upon them, and officers too often lacked the flexibility and independence of their German opposites. British infantry also suffered from the frequent transfer of their best men to special forces that did not always justify the resources poured into them. The infantry also had trouble adjusting to the Normandy terrain, particularly when it came to going in ahead of armour to winkle out German defenders from the undergrowth. Successive attacks by General Miles Dempsey's Second Army in the Caen sector highlighted the army's ongoing operational limitations. British battlefield management remained highly methodical, not least in its reliance upon prolonged preliminary artillery bombardments, and this frequently gave the Germans time in which to recover their balance. The British would also attack on narrow frontages. While this enabled them to concentrate their firepower, it cramped their room for manoeuvre, and the Germans exploited the terrain to get around their sides and harass them with flanking fire. For Operation Charnwood, on 8th and 9th July, the British poured on fire from naval guns, carpet bombing, and artillery. However, the Germans' low-flying and camouflaged defences were difficult for aerial reconnaissance to spot, and some of their larger guns, together with rocket launcher sights, were actually dummies. To avoid hitting their own men, RAF bombers left the German-held villages close to Allied positions untouched. The carpet bombing of Caen itself not only killed many French civilians, but also, as at Stalingrad and Cassino, created copious rubble for the defenders to conceal themselves in. Bombing was more accurate by the time of Operation Goodwood, which took place between 18th and 20th July. This time, however, the good work was undone by Dempsey himself. Dempsey's normally unflappable demeanour had been sorely tested by the slow progress of his troops, and for Goodwood he persuaded Montgomery to back him for a full-scale breakout. But Dempsey pushed his armour too fast, too far ahead of the infantry, and on too concentrated a front. Ultra underestimated the Germans' defensive strength, particularly the 88s along the Bourguebus Ridge. The Allied bombardment inflicted fearful losses upon the Germans, but the Germans exchanged like for like against Dempsey's armour, and their line held. The 8.8-centimetre cannons were firing one salvo after another, wrote Hans von Luck, recalling the performance of a flak battery at Cogny. One could see the shots flying through the corn like torpedoes. In the extensive cornfields to the north of the village stood at least 40 British tanks on fire or shot up. Becker's assault guns had also joined in the battle. From the right flank they shot up any tanks that tried to bypass the village. The Canadians replicated much of the British Army's faulty doctrine and training, inherited much hand-me-down British equipment, and compounded these defects with their own relative lack of experience. Among other things, they failed to replicate the effective work done by their compatriots in urban warfare in Italy. On the other hand, the Canadians sought to compensate by innovating keenly. The best example was General Guy Simons, commander of Canadian II Corps. During Operation Spring, for example, which the Canadians launched on 25 July, Simons used timed artillery fire concentrations rather than the standard creeping barrage. This confused the Germans as to when and where the Canadians would attack. Overall, the apparent sluggishness of the British and Canadians and Montgomery's, to put it charitably, difficult personality vexed the Americans intensely. Controversy continues to rage about just what Montgomery was trying to achieve in the Caen sector, the mistakes the British and Canadians made, and how far they passed up opportunities for faster progress. Yet any assessment of the British and Canadians in Normandy should recognise that both armies needed to shepherd their limited manpower carefully. And from the Germans' viewpoint, which is our concern here, the battles in the Caen sector were a drain on their own manpower and materiel. Above all, whether by accident or by design, Montgomery's British and Canadian forces were pinning down large portions of German armour that might otherwise have faced the Americans. In the Bocage country further west, the Americans had their own problems. U.S. Army training in Britain showed that its infantry, too, often lacked the necessary aggression, relied heavily on artillery bombardment, and still coordinated poorly with armour. And the fighting the Americans faced in the Bocage was hard for a further reason. Both sides sometimes exploited the terrain to employ the tactics of bush warfare, and soldiers on the receiving end of such tactics, regarded as underhand, were less minded to take prisoners. Cleanly fought, though the Normandy campaign generally was, the Bocage helped bring out its dirty side. However, thanks to their individualistic tradition, a large manpower pool and their improved supply once the Mulberries began operating, the Americans soon became innovative risk-takers and made quicker progress than their allies. For instance, the U.S. First Army aped German practice by using anti-aircraft guns as field artillery, and its aerial artillery spotters proved immensely helpful among the hedgerows of the Bocage. The Americans also became more proficient in combined arms, as their capture of Hill 192 with combined arms assault groups on 12 July testified. All along the line, then, the fact that the Allies had not broken through yet gave the Westheer a little long-term comfort. The steady, if uneven, improvement in the performance of Allied troops highlights the tendency German reports had to dwell on Allied failings to a degree that was driven less by objective reality than by an effort to fortify German troop morale. And none of this is to mention the element that made the single greatest contribution to German defeat in Normandy, Allied air power. This was not quite the all-conquering phenomenon as it is often depicted. Indeed, that image came about in large part due to the excuses made by many former German generals' post-war accounts of the campaign, which identified Allied air power as the main, if not sole, cause of their defeat. The Germans found that dispersing small defensive targets across a wide battlefield limited the devastation that massed aerial bombardment, likewise naval or artillery bombardment, could wreak upon them. They also took full advantage of the protection offered by the sturdy farmhouses, orchards, and woods that peppered the Normandy landscape. They suffered more from Allied Jabos than from heavy carpet bombing, but even then, some Allied fighter bombers, such as the RAF's Typhoon, suffered defects that limited their effect. Even so, Allied air power did the Germans serious damage. It prevented them from moving, deprived them of aerial intelligence, and wrought havoc upon a German communication system already suffering from a lack of mobile field radios and the disruptive attentions of the French resistance. "The enemy have complete mastery of the air," reported the 2nd Panzer Division on 3 August. "They bomb and strafe every movement, even single vehicles and individuals. They reconnoiter our area constantly and direct their artillery fire. Against all this, the Luftwaffe is conspicuous by its complete absence. During the last 4 weeks, the total number of German aircraft over the division area was 6. And none of this is to mention the damage Allied air power was wreaking behind the front, particularly upon the French rail network. This meant, among other things, that German troops often had to disembark from trains at least 160 to 400 kilometres, 100 to 250 miles, away from the fighting. They then had to cover the remaining distance on foot, or, if they were lucky, in hastily assembled convoys, and could only move at night. One division from the 15th Army had almost to go round in circles, from Reims to Dijon to Tours, before eventually reaching Normandy. Such was the pressure on the rail network that its troops had to be transported in 8 trains per day, when up to 60 would have been needed to move the whole division. Even when they arrived at the front, units that had gone through this experience would be in utter disarray. The state of transport also throttled the supply of vehicles and fuel to units already at the front. By 5 July, the 2nd Panzer Division had a particularly acute spare parts shortage. By 8 July, only the 21st Panzer Division had received any replacement panzers and Sturmgeschütze. The OKW had reserved 3,000 trucks with which to refit the Panzer Divisions, but these too were perilously exposed to air attack. In their desperation, the Germans regularly seized trucks from Normandy civilians. Commanders did their best to ensure such requisitions were orderly. Only officers from certain command levels upwards were permitted to order requisitioning, and private property could only be taken with financial compensation. On 30 June, 47...